This is A Lost Plot, the podcast where we explore meaning in movies together.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. It is your boy, Maverick, back with another episode of A Lost Plot. Today, we have one of our favorite guests back on with us again today. It is Andrew. Andrew, thanks for coming back.
Always a pleasure. I mean, it is to mess with you.
Yes, we'll see who's messing with who today. Because today we are reviewing Star Wars Episode 3, The Revenge of the Sith. We all saw this coming. We knew it was going to be this day someday. And, you know, what everyone's really waiting for is the review of 7, 8, and 9, which, you know, of course, we'll never do those. But Episode 3 is what's going on today. Before we get to that, we wanted to say a thank to the audience who leave us comments, leave us those reviews. We really appreciate that. The latest one that we wanted to shout out was from someone who their handle was Three Buoys, but they left us a review, and they said, "What fun. I highly enjoyed this podcast. I've never listened to a show like this, and I enjoyed thinking of and looking at movies in this new way. Thank you." Well, thank you for reviewing the podcast. We really appreciate it. And once again, if you're on any of those podcast apps, please leave us those stars, leave us a review. It helps out a small show like ours. And with that, we'll get back into it. So today, Star Wars again, but it has Hayden Christensen, everyone knows, as Anakin Skywalker. Ewan McGregor as Obi-Wan Kenobi, Natalie Portman as Padme Amidala, Ian McDiarmid as Chief Palpatine, and you know the rest. But, Andrew, what is Star Wars Episode 3, The Revenge of the Sith, about in concise fashion?
A man doesn't get the promotion he wants, so he murders his coworkers.
Okay. Okay, actually, respect the route you took with that. That's not exactly accurate, but it's a classic.
I'll be honest, you guys, with this movie, I don't think we really need to go give the whole rundown. So I think it'll be much better when we're just going through it.
I would agree. So, on a scale of 0 to 9, you know the rating system. What would you give this one, Andrew?
Like an 8.5.
Okay. I was expecting you to put it all the way up at perfection, but that's good. There we go. We have
I don't allow myself to be blinded by love. Love does not blind me.
Oh, is that the case? Okay. I gave it a 7.8. So pretty high up there, not quite as good as some other movies out there like John Wick or Gladiator or anything like that, but still pretty good. So so let's start it off.
If you're giving Star Wars Episode 3 a 7.9 or 8, whatever, John Wick gets like a negative 2.4. Okay? All right? John Wick doesn't even come close. We don't even call that a movie, all right? Much less John a franchise. As I said before, John Wick is murder porn. It's that. If you say it's anything else, you're coping.
This guy loves John Wick, but that's not what we're talking about today. Today we're talking about Star Wars. And we want to look at the opener, the opening scene. Was it one that caught your attention and made you go, "Oh my goodness, this is so good. Let's just keep watching. Let's see what happens."
100%. Loved it. Enthralled. So beautiful. Gorgeous. Wonderful.
My gosh.
Huge spaceships. Huge battle. Just what I want to see. Fending off the foreign invaders. Illegal immigration is not allowed on the planet of Coruscant.
That was not illegal immigration. That was espionage. But
So, like, if you want to talk, never mind, I'll get to that later.
Yes, we will get to a lot this time. But the opening scene is one, in case anyone needs a refresher, that's where you have the whole Palpatine's been captured by the Separatists as they are battling over Coruscant, and then they have the fight with Count Dooku, and then Count Dooku dies. all of that kind of stuff. It was a solid reintroduction. It has some of the things that was really great about other opening Star Wars movies, such as Star Wars Episode 4, Star Wars Episode 1, where you have a space battle right off the bat, really solidifies who these characters are, what's going on, all that stuff. I think it's really engaging. It's one of those solid starters. Liked it a lot. Yeah, not going to dwell too much on that. The main character. Did you think that our main character, Anakin, is compellingly flawed?
Absolutely. And this is why 1 and 2 kind of screw this up for the franchise. Because if you just have 3 and all you have is the knowledge of 1 and 2 and you don't have like the way it was visualized or executed, 3 makes so much more sense. And so you have things like the slavery with Show Don't Tell. You have things like his mom dying. You have like the whole arc with Padme without the cringy Riz fest, whatever. And so you have all of these emotions in play, and 3 is executed well, but because the buildup was so bad, 3 often gets a bad rap and is just thrown into the bunch. Whereas if you're watching 3, you open up with what the Clone Wars ends up portraying Anakin as being. You have this competent Jedi Master who is...
He's not a Jedi Master, though.
Whatever. He lost his Master in Clone Wars, but yeah. He's a Jedi Knight, all right? He's extremely competent, especially for his age, because at this point in time, he's like only 23. And most Jedi, when they're 23... are not anywhere near where Anakin is at. And so like, I think the opening scene does a good job of establishing that, because 1, it establishes he's an extremely competent pilot. You see Obi-Wan struggling, even though he's the master here. And Anakin's just like, this is nothing. Like, right. This is fine. I mean, and you don't get this a ton. And I think it's because like the space battle, at least for 3, was more of a means to an end. Like you're not witnessing the whole battle. You're witnessing like the latter end of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, but like when you think about it, like a space battle is no laughing matter. Like if your ship gets shot, there's no surviving. You're in the vacuum of space.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Which is why like most pilots, like they have all this apparatus to protect them. Like in case they like end up in space, they have some sort of like form of breathing tube or something.
You're talking about in modern space exploration, or are you talking about in the movies?
Well, even in the movies, like the Empire, if you look at like TIE fighters,
right.
Or no, I'm sorry, I'm thinking of something else. TIE fighters are like that because they don't have oxygen. It's like the pilots in TIE fighters have to have oxygen tanks on them because they're not vacuum sealed at all.
Okay, interesting.
And so anyways, like most of the people that are in space have a lot more like gear, if you will. They're more suited up. Whereas Anakin and Obi-Wan are just like, they're in their apparel. Like there's nothing between them and the vacuum of space other than the windshield.
Mm-hmm.
And so like Anakin and Obi-Wan just kind of handle that with ease. And Obi-Wan much less so, but like Anakin is able to like, they have the missiles they fire at them. He easily outmaneuvers those. Obi-Wan doesn't. Anakin ends up having to save him there. Then they end up on the ship. And I think just in the space battle scene, they do a good job establishing like, and I think they do a good job consistently establishing this despite 1 and 2's flaws, that Anakin is an above average pilot. Like he knows what he's doing behind a cockpit. And so despite 1 and 2's flaws, they keep that up. And 3 definitely is, you get props for being consistent there. And so they open it up with that. I'm curious, what do you think of as the opening scene?
So it really depends on the movie how far the opening scene extends. When I'm generally talking of the opening scene, it's a little, more or less, I look at it as what are all the necessary components to introduce all of these characters, right? And then get involved in the conflict. So it's like, usually you get the idea of these are the characters are, their competencies, all of that kind of stuff. And especially in movies like this, right, that rely on previous movies and are part of a series that tell an overarching story, right? The it's how well do they reintroduce those characters? How well do we see those characters play out on the screen? What's different about them? What's the same? Where are they at? All that kind of stuff. That's what I'm looking for in an opening scene. So I thought that they did pretty well reestablishing Anakin. There's definitely a sense in which he has a much stronger competency as a character in this movie compared to the previous two. The big thing, I think, is he still has that brashness, right, that he had in the second movie, where he was a little quick to draw his weapon. But and at the same time, he still has a greater hold on things, and you see some of his immaturity has been smoothed out. So he has his joking, fun-loving side, which still shows that aspect of it, but it's still it's more mature than what you had in the last one, where he's clearly just an immature child going about life.
I think my question was, where do you think the opening scene ends? Like, would you consider the scene ending when they're on Grievous's ship, or when they get back to Coruscant?
Probably when they get back to Coruscant. Yeah, I would. Okay. I would include the fight with Dooku in there, because it's still the same interaction, really.
That it's still whole, establishing characters,
right?
It's very part much of establishing that, the role they play,
right? Oh, sorry, and part of that too is just because in that scene you have Dooku fighting Obi-Wan and Anakin, which was what happened at the end of the last movie, right? And so it's demonstrating that growth as characters, where they are no longer as easily defeated by this Dark Lord like they were previously. So yeah. There is that. I think that that's important to note, because it helps reestablish. It also establishes the rage that can take Anakin Skywalker early on in the movie, right? Which solidifies that flaw that we're talking about, is someone who's a little more tempered, who he did something wrong and he immediately is like, I shouldn't have done that. That's not the Jedi way. And Palpatine's response is ridiculously stupid, but you know, it's a whatever. So yeah, I don't know if you have more you want to say on Anakin specifically in the introduction of the movie. Obviously, there's a big arc that goes out throughout this movie, so he'll keep coming up. But
I think the Star Wars movies, even though it's the overarching story of the Skywalker family, and Anakin ends up becoming like the main protagonist, I think it's more like he develops into it, and Obi-Wan kind of plays this weird role where he's in between a side character and a main character. And so, like, I think the movie is still a movie about Obi-Wan. Like, this is still a movie that his character is developing into. And so, at this point in time, Obi-Wan has very much... Because in the first movie, Obi-Wan is the learner. In the second movie, he is growing into his role as a father figure. Like, he's still... You can tell he's very much still figuring out how to be this father-like figure to Anakin. Mm-hmm. In the third movie, Anakin's a Jedi Knight. He's no longer an apprentice, which canonically, he basically becomes a knight within like 6 weeks of the end of the second movie. And he like goes through the trials. But like at this point in time, you very much get the sense that they're no longer a father-son duo. They're more of a like
right.
equals. And right. so they have very much grown into this, and they've shifted roles. And I think that what 3 does really, really well is it shows the transition to where Anakin still like reveres Obi-Wan. Like, he sees Obi-Wan as his superior. Mm-hmm. And yet at the same time, you get the sense that Obi-Wan recognizes that Anakin has fully grown into this Jedi Knight that he trained and essentially raised. And like, Anakin elevates Obi-Wan, and Obi-Wan like brings Anakin up with him to this sense where they're like equals. And throughout the movie, you start to really see like how much more powerful Anakin is. And I think what's interesting is the fight with Dooku very much mirrors the fight in episode 2. So if you think about it, you have Anakin who rushes in 2. And in the third movie, Obi-Wan says, this time we'll take him together. Like, they're literally mirroring it. Now, what's interesting to me is, like, there's certain things that Clone Wars will break canon for, and other things it won't. And one of the things it breaks canon for is Obi-Wan and Anakin fight him together multiple times in episode.
In the Clone Wars series.
Yeah. And then there's other things it refuses to break, like the fact that Anakin and Grievous never met. And so, I mean, I guess there's like plausible deniability. Like, I guess the last time they fought him, technically they didn't fight him together, but it's not as impactful if you're not weighing it against the episode two fight.
Right.
Which is what obviously what the movies were going for, because they were not intending to make a TV show. But what's interesting is like Anakin and him fighting together instead of apart. And this time when Obi-Wan gets thrown to the side, like literally just cast aside by Dooku, Anakin is able to hold his own against him.
Right.
Very much representing like this power increase on Anakin's part. And it's not even like a barely holding his own. It's like a, I'm owning you right now, Count Dooku. Like, you're so screwed. And now there are some things about this fight that are important to note too, that'll become more important later when we get to like the duel on Mustafar, that are mirrored. But as far as the fight goes, and like just Anakin, like also like saving the Chancellor and Obi-Wan at the same time, piloting that whole Separatist spaceship, command ship, onto Coruscant after like half of it got blown off, like all of that is just, I think they did a good job of establishing his power level while also not making him out to seem like unrealistically powerful too, which is one of the flaws that I think that 7, 8, and 9 fall into, where they're just like, oh, they've grown so powerful and they're insanely powerful. And then what it does is it makes the struggles for the rest of the movie seem unrealistic, because it's like, if they're so powerful, how are they struggling now? And so it's like there's a power differential throughout the movies. Whereas with 3, Anakin is much more powerful, but he still has his flaws. And those flaws are like, he's not super patient. He likes to rush into things. He's not the most competent fighter. He is a very competent like fighter, pilot, like all those things. Mm-hmm. But he still struggles with things.
Right. I mean, I think it's interesting to note that, especially, and I can't... I have to go back to 7, 8, and 9 when we review those to see exactly where discrepancies would exist. But specifically for the Jedi, right? One of the big things that you'll see in the movies is whenever they're facing the Separatist unit known as the Droidica, they generally try not to engage it. They simply try to get out of there, which I think is interesting that there's some level of threat that they recognize from this force that's just it's literally just a robot, but it's very powerful, and they recognize that it's a threat that they have to consider when they're in the middle of a battle. It's not a small thing. So that's one way where you will have these other things that simply help maybe balance out or bring to earth the reality of their strength and how limited it is. While they're still powerful, they do have limitations and they don't just destroy everything. So it's important to note that. But I know you noted Obi-Wan as maybe a bridge between the side characters, the main characters. Did you think that he was compelling as a character in this story? And what about the other side characters?
I think Obi-Wan's pretty compelling because he's this character who's like almost like a proud father, if you will. Mm-hmm. And you very much get that sense throughout the movie when he's like, have your glorious day with the senators. Like, this is your day. You did well. And like, even like in interactions when like Yoda and Mace Windu are asking him, is Anakin going to be able to handle this assignment with talk like spying on the Chancellor? And Obi-Wan's like, he's never failed me before. I have no doubt in my apprentice. Like he is the best of the best. And like, he's this character who's very much been raised in this organizational structure. And you get the sense that like, as the movie progresses, he starts to doubt too. He goes through almost the same journey that Anakin goes through, but he comes to the opposite conclusion.
What journey are you thinking of specifically?
This journey of doubt. And so both of them kind of are, they like idealize the Jedi Order and the Republic. Both of them see the Republic and the Jedi Order as like the right side of this fight. Mm-hmm. And Obi-Wan, as he goes through the movie, starts to notice the Jedi Order, specifically the Council, is not as perfect as he once thought. It's very simple to like the discussion we have about Gladiator, about like how like this is that they have this idealized version of what this organizational structure is. Right. And Obi-Wan, especially when they start to ask him to do things that are like compromising to his character, specifically Anakin's, like he even sympathizes with him. And he's like, this is war. Like, this is just what we do. Mm-hmm. Like, we have to compromise sometimes. But you still get the sense of like he's like, he's not enjoying it. Right. And so Anakin is going on a similar journey. And what makes Obi-Wan's character interesting is that he's still looking out for Anakin. And you get the sense that he knows about him and Padme. Like, it's kind of obvious that he does. And yet he kind of turns a blind eye. And it's almost like he just, he knows, like, there's something within him where he knows, like, telling Anakin no to that wouldn't be the right thing to do. And it kind of goes back to, like, the lessons that Qui-Gon taught him where he's like, well, you need to obey the Council. And he says, I will do what I must. And so mm-hmm. Obi-Wan is kind of, like, recognizing, like, yes, the Council is great, but there are some things that, like, I will subvert. And when it comes to Anakin, he's willing to have a little bit longer of a leash because he trusts him. Now, I don't know. I think his journey is much different than Anakin's, and it's not as fleshed out. But he still goes from this idealistic character to, like, how could we have been so blind?
You mean about Palpatine specifically, or just in regards to the whole corruption of Anakin throughout the story?
I think both of those are technically Palpatine, because like, how could I have been both so blind to the fact that Anakin went to this other father figure? And it also kind of makes him feel guilty. Like, what? How was I failing as his father figure to make him go pursue this other person to find like validation? Because that's ultimately what happens. Is Anakin's looking for validation and his like. Discussed with some of the things that the Council is having him do, and Obi-Wan tries to give that, but Palpatine does exactly what Anakin, like, he knows exactly what to say to make Anakin feel validated.
Well, and that's maybe one thing that I feel that this movie lacks to a certain degree some context for, is just this strong relationship between Anakin and Palpatine is already an established fact at this point in the story. And you really don't get the impression, you're not really sure how they got to that point, because you really don't get that same interaction into or one at all, that this character is very close to Palpatine, or Anakin is very close to Palpatine. So it's I think one of the few areas where I get that definitely exists. This movie indicates by all means that there's a close relationship that Anakin has with both Obi-Wan and Palpatine. But whereas we see Obi-Wan's relationship develop with Anakin, you don't really see that in the same way with Palpatine, which is only important because I think the buy-in in regards to his fall as a character would be more believable if they had that background where you know that familiarity. Does that make sense?
I see what you're saying. I think it's interesting because, like, I think this goes back to the whole, like, one and two would have been better if they did it a little bit differently.
Right.
Because, like, with three, they definitely established that. And over time, it's like they grow closer because of Anakin's assignment. But you also have the fact that, like, there are little hints that things have happened since two. Where because of the Clone Wars, the Jedi and the Republic have become much more intertwined. And so it's like Anakin has kind of started confiding in the Chancellor. And I mean, Chancellor Palpatine kind of expressed that he was interested in Anakin even in the first movie.
Right. Right.
I mean, I guess it could have been done a little better. I think overall, though, it's not like a major indictment on the movie because they still – it's not like a complete shock to the audience.
No.
Like
you see it happening all across episode three is this conversion. And at some points, sure, it might feel disjointed. That's probably a problem more with the dialogue than anything else. But the actual – because that is one thing I was surprised about when I watched it this time is I recalled feeling like his corruption as a character was rushed. But as I watched it recently, I realized that's really not the case. If anything, there is quite a few scenes where they slowly put down the pieces to bring Anakin to this place. It's just, like I said, probably the dialogue is what really makes it odd at certain points, especially when the actual switch happens. There's some really stupid dialogue there, but you know, what can I say? Lucas isn't known for his dialogue.
True.
Yeah. Anyway, and this is, I think Lucas is to me the biggest testament to you can write a good storyline with bad dialogue. And I hate bad dialogue, but if the fundamentals are written well, you can still have very compelling characters, very compelling backstories, very compelling arcs. And he does that, you know, the cheesy lines in episode four doesn't stop episode four from being a classic. It's true. Still a classic.
Yeah.
What about some of the other side characters, like Padme, even the Separatists to a certain degree were a little interesting, I think, in this one compared to the previous movies.
I think there's a couple of things. In terms of Padme, I think one of the downfalls of this movie is just that there was so much content that Lucas had to cut out, and a massive portion of that was Padme's character arc. Because in three, you have the two arcs. You have Obi-Wan on Utapau with the 212th Legion. Right. And then you have, and you have that whole fight. And then you have Anakin on Coruscant watching Chancellor Palpatine. And the thing that makes it so interesting is like Padme was supposed to have her own arc too. That was supposed to intersect with those other two. Mm. And her whole arc is like the Republic has massively shifted from where it was before.
Mm-hmm.
And you even get the sense when Anakin, before Obi-Wan leaves for Utapau, there's that scene where he runs into this like meeting room and Obi-Wan's like, "You missed the briefing." It's like, "What happened?" He tells him like, General Voss has removed his troops from Voss Pity or something. And then he tells him, but like in like a more distressed tone, the Republic or the Senate is like, we expect them to vote more emergency powers to the Chancellor.
Mm-hmm.
Anakin is like, well, that's a good thing. Less fighting. We'll get this done sooner. And it also shows you an interesting like dynamic between the two, because they view the world fundamentally different. And you even get the sense from Anakin and 2, which is something I do like about what 2 does, because at least they're building up to something.
nice.
You have that dialogue between Anakin and Padme when they're talking. I mean, it's the one redeeming part of the whole Naboo like interaction. You have their conversation about politics. And Padme is talking about like democracy and how Republic should work. And Anakin's like, I think we just get a bunch of people in one room and have them discuss. And Padme's like, that's literally what we do. Just a really big room. And he's like, well, I think we should just have one guy. And she's like, who determines that? She's like, you? And he's like, no, someone wise that like knows how to do those things. And what's interesting is that they don't explore that dialogue very much, but it's very insightful into Anakin's character. He's very much a man of action. And you even, it's like, there are these little glimpses of Vader in him early on. And like, it's no wonder he endorses like the Empire as a whole, because it is not a Republic. There's no deliberating. There's one overarching individual who rules it all and gets things done quickly. And so like Anakin, if anything, and the Clone Wars does this really well too, is he hates bureaucracy. He absolutely just despises endless debates and discussions, because he knows what he wants. He knows what he wants to do, and he wants to get it done. And you get that in episode four too, when he walks into that like council with all these Imperial officers
in the Death Star. Yeah.
Yeah. And he just chokes one out. He's like, yeah. you fool. And so like Anakin and Obi-Wan kind of have that difference there too. But what's interesting, sorry, that was a long tangent. What's interesting is that the whole arc with Padme was supposed to be showcasing almost like a dissenting group within the Republic, with Bail Organa, Mon Mothma, Padme, mm-hmm. and senators who were like worried about how much power the Chancellor was amassing to himself. Mm-hmm. What's interesting is you get little glimpses of American politics in Episode 3, which heavily influenced Lucas too. Like, you have so many influences from like World War II, Vietnam, Nazi Germany. One of the influences for Palpatine was actually FDR, is what's interesting to me. And the major influence, and there's only a few lines where it talks about this, but it talks about how Palpatine's been in office for far too long. And FDR had been in office, he got four terms.
I just knew that's where you were going, but keep going.
I mean, you can. What is so funny?
Nothing. Just keep going. I just thought the fact that you brought this up, I just thought was a funny situation, and the fact that you got pissed about it only made it more funny.
Okay.
Keep going. I want to hear the completion of this thought.
So like FDR is, whether or not you like FDR or not, there's no denying the fact that he amassed a lot of power to himself as president. Like because we were involved in a world war, he just had so many excuses to just do things, like taking all the gold in the United States, multiple executive orders that just massively infringe on like constitutional freedoms. And you can argue he had a reason for it, he didn't, whatever. Mm-hmm. Lucas saw that and liked that persona for a character, and that's why like the character of Palpatine mimics a lot of American politics, because he's using the excuse of war to amass power to himself. Mm-hmm. You have like the fact that FDR was fighting against this nation that was seen as evil, right? And now I'm not going to argue that World War II, we were not fighting evil people, okay?
Yeah.
There's the parallel is not perfect, right? But you get like the sense from the separatist point of view is we're not evil. And what's interesting is the separatists, like the main heads of the separatists are corrupt. They're in this for the wrong reasons. But a lot of the people that are part of the Separatist Alliance are just planetary systems that don't want to be under the like influence of the Republic. Mm-hmm.
Right.
And what's interesting is you have that 4-episode arc. I'm going to be bringing Clone Wars into this because there's a ton of stuff in there that's interesting. You have the Umbara arc, right, with the clones, the 501st, and they're on that like dark, foggy planet trying to subdue it.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm talking about? It's the one with the Palm Crow. Here's the two double
fighters.
Yeah. What's interesting is that whole arc was based off Vietnam.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
Yeah. And so you get like this guerrilla warfare. You have the fact that we see them as insurgents, when really the Umbarans in that episode were just fighting for their freedom. They didn't want to be a part of the Republic, but the Republic was going to force them to like submit and be a part of this. And so like the Umbarans weren't like inherently vengeful. Now, again, it's not a perfect parallel to the real world, but it's interesting.
Sure. Yeah.
And so with Palpatine and FDR, like he is a character who's amassing power to himself. And so the whole Padme arc was supposed to show her kind of becoming the second separatist group. Because that's why the separatists originally were
about. Oh, yeah. Okay, and I see what you're saying.
It was supposed to be showing this splinter group. Now, here's where it gets interesting. the arc also plays into the division between Anakin and Padme, because Padme is trying to appeal to the Chancellor that he's doing things that are like violating the liberties of the people that are in the Republic. And Anakin sees the Chancellor as like this perfect wise man, but also keep in mind, Anakin is like his bodyguard right now. Right. He's with him everywhere. And so there's one scene that they ended up cutting where Padme appeals the Chancellor and the and Anakin standing there. And then afterwards, the Chancellor uses it as like ammunition to divide Anakin, to put like a divide there. And so you have an arc where they're intermixing, but again, Padme and Anakin's worldviews in terms of like the role of a government are vastly different. And so I think Padme's character is massively suffering because you don't have the scenes in there that build off of her character, because her character is very much a character that's all about freedom, fighting for the people, doing it through legitimate means, working by the book, by the law. And there's very few instances where she goes against that in the Clone Wars, but in the movie, she's very much do this by the book. We need to do what's right. We need to fight for these people. And you can get it at the end when she goes, so this is how liberty dies, with thunderous applause.
Right.
And so, like, I think her character has a lot of potential, isn't really explored. I think another side character that's interesting is Yoda. I mean, you have, he's this master who's been around for 900 years. He's watched so much change since his, like, since he was just a knight or a youngling in the temple. And now he's Grand Master. And he is, like, he is trying to figure out, how do I handle this shift? Like, what am I supposed to do with this? He's starting to have trouble like meditating and seeing things clearly. Like, he doesn't know who the Sith Lord is. He doesn't know what's going on with the Chancellor.
Right.
He is concerned about keeping peace with the galaxy with the Jedi Knights that he has at his disposal, while also making sure that he carries on this tradition. And Anakin, you have that scene when Anakin goes to meet with him, and Yoda's like genuinely disturbed. Like, he's trying to figure out how to help Anakin. And you even get this in 1 and 2, where Yoda's like, I don't, like, he knows Anakin is the chosen one. Like, Yoda doesn't have any doubts about that. Mace Windu expresses doubt, just Yoda doesn't. But Yoda's
he does have that line where he goes, like, a prophecy which might have been misinterpreted, more or less. Right, when Obi was like, well, he is the chosen one, isn't he? So doesn't that indicate doubt on Yoda's side?
It's more like his doubt is that it's like the whole, and I don't want to compare it. I hate like the comparison to Jesus, but it's similar in that like their view of who Jesus would be was a lot different than who he was. And so while he still fulfilled the prophecy, it wasn't in the way that they expected. It's like the expectation for, I'm trying to be serious here.
I know. I just like that. And that is where the comparison ends right there.
Yes.
Keep going.
Anakin's whole character, like the expectation for the chosen one was he's just going to be this awesome, powerful Jedi who's going to take on the forces of evil head on and kill them. Mm-hmm. But no, I mean, he still fulfills the prophecy until you get 7, 8, 9. Mm-hmm. It's not in the way that people expected. And so it's like Yoda is sitting here in 3, and I think his whole thing about like how it's misinterpreted is like he's starting to doubt, like, how is this all going to unfold? Are we actually going to live through this? Like, what is this person, Anakin, what is he going to go through? Because Yoda definitely empathizes with who Anakin's character is. Like, he's seen so many different people throughout his life. And he even though Anakin doesn't really interact with Yoda on a large scale, there are some arcs in the Clone Wars where he does, and even like in Star Wars, there's the movies. Like, Yoda is very much like, it's almost like Yoda is emotionally distant. It's like he can't really feel like emotions, but he understands that he needs, like, Anakin needs things that can't be given to him by the Order, and he doesn't know how to handle this. Because remember, Yoda grew up in an organization where emotions were shunned. You were brought in at birth, and you didn't have to handle that. And so Anakin is this wild card. He's like, this is someone who experiences emotions and all the things that normal people handle. Mm-hmm. And yet he's the chosen one. So we have to have him here. But I don't know how to have him here. Mm-hmm. And so, like, he's very much this character who's like, and I think that's what's interesting about his character, is all the Jedi are in the dark. But Yoda recognizes he's in the dark, and that terrifies him more than anything. But I think because of that, it means he is best capable of responding to what happens in the later half of the movie.
You mean when he fights Palpatine and all that?
His character is very much like, I don't know what's happening, and he's just like waiting for something to unfold. And then it unfolds, and he's like, okay, I knew something was going to happen. Now I'm responding to it. And so his character very much shifts once all this stuff goes down, where he's like, this is what was clouding my judgment. This is what I was unsure of.
And this is what we need to do. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Especially, and you see that maybe because he has that cautiousness, that he's actually aware of more of what's going on, so that when Order 66 occurs later on in the movie, he knows he's ready and he actually survives that encounter, whereas
Yeah. Other did not. Exactly.
What did you think about the motivations in this movie? Was there a risk of sacrifice in this story? And also, did you think the villain was compelling?
Well, who's the villain?
See, that's the question. Who do you think the villain is?
I'd say it's a mixture of Sidious and Anakin. Because it's weird. You have a character who's both the hero and the villain for different halves of the movie. Mm-hmm. And it's like the hero and the villain is both Anakin and Vader. And I think it's interesting if you split them into two people. Mm-hmm. Have the character of Anakin Skywalker, who is a loving, empathetic, caring, kind, heroic individual who has grown into his powers. And then you have the character of Vader, who is arrogant, prideful, rash, does not have empathy for others. He is rageful, hateful, angry, but also very powerful. And so within Anakin, you see these two personas fighting for control. And you see it at the very beginning, when he cuts off Dooku's head, and you see like a moment where Vader comes out. Mm-hmm. You see Vader come out when he's granted the rank of a knight, and he's a seat on the council, but he doesn't get the rank of master. Mm-hmm. And you see it come out for a little bit. And I think it's interesting where people are like, oh, Hayden did a horrible job of playing him, which I'll get more in depth there. But I think it's really interesting to see that shift where it's like he's fighting this. It's very much his human nature. He's fighting his human nature.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
It comes out a little bit later too, like when he's talking to Palpatine. And then when Palpatine tells him that he's the Sith Lord, you see Anakin come out. The heroic Jedi Knight who's standing off with him. And he tells him, no, stop right there. But then when he goes to report to Mace Windu, Sundu leaves. And then you have that scene. And there's so much there with no dialogue, where Anakin is just staring outside the windows of the Jedi Temple. Right. And you can just like, it's so unfortunate because I feel like so many people see that scene and they just glance over it. But there's so much there in like the shots, the music, the lighting, the face of Anakin. You can see him very much like he starts out just kind of there and he starts to pace. And it's in that moment that you sort of have Vader slowly taking a hold.
Right. And this is after he has realized that Darth Sidious is Emperor Palpatine and that he let Mace Windu know that he has found Darth Sidious and tells him where to go. And then Mace Windu tells him to stay in the Jedi Temple, right? And that's when you have this scene. Yeah.
Absolutely. And so I think it's just, it's very interesting because at that moment, Anakin, he has his fears of Padme dying, and he has the solution. But the solution is the very thing he is sworn to destroy. And so it's like he has to choose now. Do I choose the right thing, or do I choose to save the one that I love? And he's been put in this false dichotomy almost, because it's not true that it's an either or, but Palpatine has put it in such a way and manipulated him in such a way that he sees it as such.
Right. Well, and this is what I think is interesting about what they did in the second one that they brought into this one, and that is the dreams, in that they played off the dreams very well in that movie compared to this movie, which is that Anakin is having these dreams about his mother in pain and suffering, and he goes to try to save her. He follows the dreams, right? But he doesn't follow them right away. And when he follows the dreams, he finds her, and he's just shy of saving her, right? And in his mind, it's almost like, if I could have done more, I could have stopped this from happening, or if I had acted sooner, whatever it is. The dream set up the scenario in such a situation where it appears that he actually could have made a difference to change the outcome of the situation. And so that's what he has as the background for coming into this movie, where he's having these same dreams and he's thinking, I need to do something to stop this from happening. And that's what Palpatine plays off of, is that he thinks, oh, I have to do something. I have the solution. And it is this dichotomy, choose this or that. When it doesn't necessarily have to be that dichotomy, but because of these past experiences, it's all that Anakin can think of.
Yeah. And the thing that's interesting is both Yoda and Palpatine know about the visions, and they know about his mom. The difference is Palpatine knows what Anakin did when his mom died. Yoda knows that he had the visions. He knows that his mom died. And now he knows that he's having more visions about Padme. Well, he doesn't know it's Padme. He knows it's someone close to him.
Right.
And then Palpatine has that same information plus a little more. And so Palpatine takes that information and uses it to his advantage. Yoda has that information. He's like, this is a piece of the puzzle I'm not understanding. And so I think it's very interesting the way that you go from, like, the beginning of the movie, all Anakin. And then you start to get little spurts of Vader. And then as the movie goes on, you get this shift, and now you have more and more and more Vader, and then you get splurts of Anakin until the very end, when there's just nothing.
Right, right. And yeah, that's him trying to justify the path that he's going down in his mind by saying, I'm doing all these good things for you, or for the Republic, or for the whatever it is that he's fighting for at that time. He's justifying in his mind.
I don't even think that would be, I would, like, characterize that as Anakin. I think the last time we see Anakin, the persona that I have called Anakin is when he's standing on that, like, gangplank, if you will, that, like, walkway on Mustafar, and you see him looking out, and there's just tears streaming down his face. Mm-hmm. As okay. He's yeah. Like, what have I become? Like, I had such an idealized version of what it meant to be a Jedi and who I would become and the people I would save as this boy on Tatooine. And now I'm here on Mustafar. I have slaughtered hundreds of innocent children. I've killed and destroyed the entire order that I used to stand for. And now I'm serving this regime.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this whole justification is for Padme, right? And I think that his snap at that point in the movie is interesting, but we'll get to that. I do think that his internal struggle is a big part of this movie. And when he turns, him becoming a villain, he's still the main character, but he does become a villain, but it's a lot about that internal struggle and who he becomes throughout this. Yeah. Did you think that there was an ideal in this movie or not?
I think loyalty is a big one. And the reason why is it kind of goes back to, like, where do I draw the line? And I talked about this in the podcast for one, when Obi-Wan's like, I'll do what I must. Mm-hmm. And I think what else is interesting is, like, the question of, and I don't know, maybe this is me getting too philosophical about it, but, like, what is right and wrong in terms of the Star Wars universe? Because it's like, to Anakin, it's like, well, of course it's right to save other people. But is it right to save other people at the expense of others? Mm-hmm. So, like, Anakin kind of comes to the conclusion that he does, where it's like, I mean, he almost accepts that it's selfish what he's doing. But, Obi-Wan, the fight between Obi-Wan and Anakin in 3 is just
Okay, that's you might be true, but that's a bit. Also, this movie has like more than double the lightsabers on screen than any other Star Wars movie, except for maybe 7. I think it is. I'm not sure.
No, General Grievous easily doubles that by himself.
Okay, no. I mean, like screen time, not actual lightsabers. Oh,
screen time. Yeah, definitely does because you have. You have the entirety of Order 66, which showcases multiple Jedis. You have the duel on Mustafar. You have Yoda versus Sidious. You have Anakin and Obi-Wan versus Dooku. I mean, you have all the Jedi versus Palpatine, and then you have Anakin over there. Like, it's just, you have the whole assault on the Jedi Temple. Like, this is just lightsabers out the wall.
Master Skywalker. There's too many of them.
What are we going to do?
Yeah, I thought a lot about, and I don't know if this is a perfect representation, but I did think that love was a very strong concept in this movie. And I think that that's maybe where this one has more cohesion compared to other movies, where you have very different things that Obi-Wan's going for versus Qui-Gon or Obi-Wan versus Anakin in these previous movies. In this one, I do think that there's a lot of discussion about what is the right thing to do, and what does, you know, letting go of the things that you're afraid to lose, and what the truly caring thing is, right? And love is a strong motivating force for Anakin, and he says he loves Padme, and that's his singular focus for a good portion of his actions in this movie. Versus Obi-Wan, I think his care for Anakin and his love for Anakin is one thing that keeps him from revealing his relationship with Padme, right? Or like trying to see if he can save him, and he doesn't want to fight him, right? And all these other things. And how the difference is that it's a discussion on what real love looks like, because in some ways the love that Anakin has turns to become selfish, versus the love that Obi-Wan has is a selfless kind of thing. And there's even a discussion that Anakin has with Palpatine on this type of thing, where he says, well, the Jedi are selfless, and this selflessness of them is what separates them from the Sith. And it's interesting that selfless aspect of his love goes out the window by the end of the movie, and he becomes a selfish man who feels hurt and anger and all these things that start to drive him, because what he thinks is love is rebuffed because it's not real love.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that helps to have that contrast between the two, especially by the end where they have their showdown. But not getting too caught up in everything, the heightened tension. Does the movie consistently put the hero in a worse situation as the story progresses?
Yeah, Anakin, I think his progression, and it's not like a physical danger, but it's like as the movie progresses, he is slowly... like more and more influenced by Palpatine and what Palpatine has to say. Mm-hmm. And it's like, he's like the trials, if you will, of like the test of will he survive this encounter with Palpatine becomes worse and worse for him. Mm-hmm. To the point where he literally confronts him about being the Dark Lord of the Sith. And it's like, oh, snap.
I agree. I'd say that the only thing that was lacking to me, which is, I already said this earlier, is that I think it would have been great if we had seen more of Anakin and Palpatine's relationship before this, to see why they have such a strong relationship, rather than just kind of springing it on us. One thing that I was curious about, this is more of a side bit, but there's a line that Palpatine says to Anakin where he says, to cheat death is a power that only one has achieved. Do you know what, I'm assuming you know what that refers to?
Yes, I do.
Do you want to enlighten me?
It's Darth Plagueis, the wise, who was Palpatine's master.
Okay.
Go ahead.
That's what I thought, but then he has those lines in there where he says, have you heard the tale of Darth Plagueis the Wise? And he goes through all his little thing, and then he says he taught everything to his student, and then his student killed him in his sleep, right? And so then later on in the story, Palpatine says, like, the path to immortality is a power that only one has achieved, but I think we can figure it out if we work together, which indicates like he didn't learn it. So I was a little confused by that. Is like, does that mean he's actually referring to Plagueis as his master? Is he not? Like, what all was going on there? Was that just a misunderstanding on my part? But I guess like the trail of logic doesn't seem to follow in my mind. That's why I was confused.
Does he actually say like everything I taught? He taught me everything.
I'm pretty sure. It would be worth double checking, fact checking me on that.
All right, let me look at it. Yes, he does say. Unfortunately, he taught his apprentice everything he knew. Here's the thing. You have to keep in mind that Palpatine is a deceiver.
So, Andrew's answer: he was lying.
Lying's not off the table. And so, I think what's interesting is Palpatine. 9 doesn't do it justice, but Palpatine does cheat death multiple times.
Well, that's like, why we have 9. It's so good.
In Legends, Palpatine ends up making clones of himself. And so they're not actually Palpatine. They're like an actual clone, which is what Snoke was, which is more permissible than like Palpatine actually still being alive. And so like Palpatine like knows the like basic process of keeping someone alive, from my understanding. But he doesn't have the power to achieve it.
Okay.
It's like how Jedis know how to become a Force ghost. Like, the knowledge is there, but they haven't all trained. There's that option, or there's just simply the fact that Plagueis taught him everything he knew, and Palpatine knew how to do things and just decided not to tell Anakin.
Okay. And when it's saying, like, the Force ghost, is that the path to immortality that Yoda was speaking of for Qui-Gon?
Yes.
Okay.
Now, Plagueis actually knew how to cheat death. Like, they're in the books, he kills someone and then brings them back to life.
Oh, okay. Wow.
So, crazy. Plagueis is, like, actually really powerful.
Nice.
I think also the other thing is, like, even though, like, he could bring other people back to life, he can't bring himself back to life.
Right, which is exactly what he says in the tale. Revelations. Did you think that there was a big revelation in this movie? And does the movie have a surprise ending?
It's kind of hard to have a surprise ending when there's three more movies that come afterwards that came first.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I guess if you had, you'd never seen 1, 2, and 3... Palpatine being the Dark Lord of the Sith might be a bit of a surprise. Because, like, you kind of get the idea that Palpatine is not the most upstanding citizen, but not that he's the Sith Lord, just from watching 1, 2, and 3. Like, there are hints there, but it's not the most obvious thing. I mean, especially if you haven't watched Clone Wars. Like, Clone Wars makes it much more obvious.
I mean, yeah, it's definitely, in regards to a revelation that changes everything, that is a revelation that changes everything, right?
It might not be something that's a revelation to the audience, but it could be a revelation. Yeah, it's a revelation to those within the story.
And I think revelations generally, when you're looking for them, is this is something specifically for the audience that surprises them, that adds a whole new perspective to the movie. I think because it's kind of obvious they're building up to Palpatine at the very least not being an upstanding guy, I think it's pretty obvious that he's the bad guy, so I don't think it's a surprise to anyone who's watching it that he's evil, but it does change a lot. I would give it like half points on that because you can see how much it changes. It's not a real mind bender. I do think that the ending, even with you knowing what's going to happen, has somewhat of a surprise, or at least a knockout bit at the end where it shows Anakin as Darth Vader, right? And he's being lifted up on the table, and then they say, he asks about Padme, and he goes, where is Padme? Is she alive? Is she safe? And then Sidious says, it appears that in your anger, you killed her. right? And it turns out that he was the fulfillment of the very dream that he was fearing. And that was this poetic justice for the evil that Anakin had been doing, that in all of this effort to save the one he loved, that he did all of these terrible, terrible things. And at the end of the day, it is because he did those terrible things that his dreams actually occurred. So I think that at the very least was one of those climactic knockout endings to leave people in a note on. And I gave it points for that because I thought that was a good touch.
Yeah.
Okay. Did you think that the hero grew as a person?
Well, he definitely got an extra 12 inches to his height.
He got a plastic helmet. Helps protect the brain. Well, he learned to deal in absolutes, so that's good. That's awesome. What do you think about that?
I think we have a Christian on our hands.
So you love that line. That's awesome. That's so good.
Only a Sith deals in absolutes, even though this is an absolute and I'm not a Sith. Definitely makes sense. Logic, my dude.
Okay, well, at least you're willing to admit it. That's good.
Yeah, I don't know. I think in terms of revelation, it was good. I think the best part of the movie was the fight on Mustafar, which we haven't talked about yet, and I'm waiting for.
Okay, well, I want to get to one thing before we get to that fight. Sheev Palpatine makes the argument that the Jedi Order is going to try to take over the Republic, right? And then you hear these discussions amongst the Jedis, like Yoda, Windu, all these things about potentially having to do the very thing that Palpatine was afraid of and become this force governing the galaxy, at least in their eyes temporarily, right? In some ways, that justifies Palpatine's concerns as much as he's the bad guy and his solution isn't better. But it made me think that there's a certain sense in which all of the Republic was doomed regardless of the outcome. What are your thoughts on that?
I think this is a great parallel to the 2020 election.
Okay.
You have an instance of something.
I tried to decide if you're like checked out mentally or not.
I think it is a great symbol of how far America has fallen today.
Okay.
You have a political figure who warns that people will come for his office, even though he knows he shouldn't be there anymore. And you have people like Biden now in the 2024 election who are warning that Trump will come for his office. And when Trump does come for his office, they'll say, look at that. And it's like, we knew it was happening already, buddy. Plus, everything surprises you now, even an ice cream truck.
Okay.
Here's the thing. I think Palpatine is a devious little bat. Okay. He knows what he's doing, all right? He's been at this for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that makes Palpatine interesting is he knows how politics work. He knows how people work. And he knows that he's suspicious. And so he's like pulling all these strings. And the fact that he's also running the entirety of the Separatist army makes him a lot more influential than one would think.
Mm-hmm.
And so like his whole thing with Anakin is like, the Jedi are like spying on me. I don't know why they're spying on me, even though he knows why they're spying on him. And then Anakin finds out, oh, they actually are spying on him. And so it adds to Palpatine being like, I don't know why they're on me. He says, the Jedi are going to try to take over. And then, okay, but okay. As much as I love Anakin, he's kind of stupid for this. He goes, Palpatine tells him, I am the Sith Lord. And he goes, all right, I'm going to go get the Jedi. He brings the Jedi. The Jedi go over there, try to fight him. And then he shows up and Palpatine's like, the Jedi are taking over. Yeah, no duh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And like, I think it's also interesting to see kind of like the Vader and Anakin with his little rationale of like, he needs a fair trial and yet he didn't do jack diddly squat for Dooku when he cut off his head. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what's funny is Mace Windu says the exact same thing Palpatine does about Dooku. He says he's too dangerous to be kept alive. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing Palpatine said about Dooku and the same justification for why Anakin should kill him. And Anakin's not buying it. He's like, well, I actually care about this guy, so no.
Well, it's interesting to see how that kind of, as clearly contradictory as that is, people act like that all the time, where they'll say one thing and then say something completely different in another situation because it supports their side or what they agree with or whatever it is. And it goes, okay, you've given up logical consistency for the sake of having to, for defending this viewpoint or this belief that you want to believe. And it's like, it's a very human thing to do, but it's played out perfectly in this movie.
Yeah.
I feel like you want to talk about the fight scene, so I wanted to open up the floor for you.
Oh, I'm not there yet. I hyped myself up a little bit more. Okay. I thought I would do that talking.
You're about the one that's been looking like a little turd sitting there.
Okay, don't diss the brown jacket.
Okay, I wasn't even talking about that.
or my hair.
There we go.
Shut up. All right, so
apparently the fight scene on Mustafar was kind of crap. If you think about it, it was about like 30 minutes of just straight lightsaber fighting where it's the same person fighting the other person in a different scene. And so
if you want the serious version of all of this, we need to start back at Order 66.
Sure.
Okay. What's interesting about all of this, and one of the flaws I think that the movie has, is there's such a lack of character for the clones. It just doesn't exist. And so I think Order 66 becomes much more impactful when you start introducing the Clone Wars, because you humanize them. And so you don't simply have this like, oh, our soldiers turned on us, whatever sort of thing. Mm-hmm. You start to humanize the clones, but you also humanize the Jedi that they're killing, because now you've interacted with these characters, and it's much, there's a lot more emotion going on in that scene than simply, oh, pew, dead Jedi, pew, dead Jedi, pew, dead Jedi. Mm-hmm. Also, when you realize the fact that Aayla Secura was sleeping with her clone commander and he still shot her, it's kind of like, whoa. That's some next level crap right there. Mm-hmm. And there's theories that Plo Koon survived. Kylo Mundy definitely died. There's a deleted scene where Quinlan Voss was supposed to get like rammed by a turbo tank. Like he's in the back and a turbo tank, like this is one turbo tank, this is the other one. And the boss is like right here and he just goes and just squishes him. There was supposed to be a flamethrower scene.
Whoa.
Shaak Ti, that's one of her death scenes, was leading a clone unit. She was also supposed to get killed by Grievous aboard Invisible Hand, I think was the name of the ship. And then she was also supposed to get killed by Anakin at the Jedi Temple, but they ended up just getting rid of her deaths altogether, so we didn't even know what happened to her.
That's hilarious. Of all the Jedi that they cut that out for. We even get Kit Fisto's death.
Here's what I think would be cool. You saw the Clone Wars arc with those six younglings, right?
Yeah.
I think having at least like a Clone Wars arc of them trying to survive the Jedi Holocaust would be awesome. Okay? And hear me out here. You could have some epic scenes, all right? Like, you know the Mexican Jedi boy, Pedro?
No, but okay. I'm sure. Was he one of those six? I just don't remember their names right.
He was. Okay. So he has like a blue lightsaber. He was the arrogant one.
Yeah, I kind
of have a scene
that.
Where like most of them die and like maybe two of them survive. Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking the Wookiee because the Wookiee's based and someone else. Have a scene where he like destroys a door and they get through, but he's there to hold off Jedi. Okay? He turns off his lightsaber. And, like, you hear clones shuffling into this dark room. But you don't see anything. Mm-hmm. And then you see him start to kill clones, but you only see the light that comes off his lightsaber. And it, like, can, like, reflect off their armor, and you can see the bolts, and that's the only source of light in this scene.
Right.
And but it's not simply just him, like, having it on constantly. It's like he turns it on to impale a trooper, turns it back off. Turns it on to cut off someone's head, turns it off. Mm-hmm. And so I just think it'd be cool to have like that, like just these light, quick swish, flick, die, decapitate, impale. There goes a leg. Oh, so based. And they're just like shooting into the dark because they can't see jack squat. And then in the darkness, you can like hear him breathing heavily. Like it's silent now. You assume they're all dead and he's like panting. And you, it's like a shot from like kind of like not from like head on, but like slightly upwards, and you can see the his lightsaber's on now, and then he turns it off and you hear him panting, and then all of a sudden you see a pair of yellow eyes right behind him, and then the scene cuts.
And he's so done anyways.
It's so good.
You're
Why?
No, I'm just kidding. You're just like, it's not a bad idea. It's just unlikely that Disney will listen to you or me or anyone because they're all turds.
True, but you have to agree that would be an awesome scene.
It would be.
In terms of like the reveal, because like you also got to ask yourself, like there's different reveals for the characters than there are for the audience because the audience has more knowledge. It's like you have meta knowledge of this movie, what's going on. Mm-hmm. Like Obi-Wan and Yoda's reveal of what happened was actually, I think, really done really well because Yoda's like looking at it and they're like, these are lightsaber marks. Who did this?
Right. Right.
And it's like Yoda is like, he kind of knows. You get the sense that he knows what happened. And Obi-Wan has no clue. And he mm-hmm. goes to see what happened and Yoda's like, don't do it. You don't want to know.
Yeah.
And Obi-Wan is like in shock and Yoda's like, all right. I know what we got to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so then we get to the duel on Mustafar.
Andrew's favorite scene in all of Star Wars.
Where to begin? There's actually a really great
documentary on this. If you just like describe every single one of these scenes as a play-by-play and then go, it was so cool, I'm going to cut it from this entire episode.
That's not what I'm going to do. Okay. But there are a couple of interesting things to note about that scene. So first of all, for the music.
Which has nothing to do with the plot line, but sure, go ahead.
No, the music does have to do with the plot because music conveys a lot of emotion without actually visualizing it. It sort of adds a lot to a scene.
It can, yes.
And it does definitely in this scene. Like the music definitely plays into the emotions you're trying to invoke. And so Lucas went to Williams and said, here's what I need. And he explained the setting. He's like, okay, I'll come back in like 4 or 5 months. Have some music for me. Mm-hmm. And then he left. And while he was gone, like they did several really interesting things. Like they actually got real footage of a volcano erupting.
Nice.
They like took a plane and like went and got this footage. So there's like some of the like explosions, like lava, like explosions on Mustafar, like that's actual footage of a volcano.
That's awesome.
There is a couple of parts where the water, the way that they, or not water, the lava flow, they had to reverse the scene to get the movements right. But when they do, the lava is moving in the opposite direction it's supposed to be if you watch closely.
Are you talking about when they're floating down fighting each other?
Not like this part, but like the water, the lava falls coming down.
Yeah, okay.
The way that the fight unfolds, there's a couple of interesting things that happen. One, they mirror the fight with Dooku at the beginning because there's a scene where Anakin tries to pull the same move on Obi-Wan that he pulled on Dooku where he cuts off his hands, but Obi-Wan counters it.
Interesting.
And then at the end, when he says, I have the high ground, what's interesting is that like Anakin could have easily just like hopped onto the bank and kept fighting. Mm-hmm. Anakin has come to the point where he's like so engrossed in the idea that he is the most powerful there is, that he's going to attempt to do to Obi-Wan what Obi-Wan did to Darth Maul in episode one. And so that move that he does, where he jumps over him, is what Obi-Wan did to Darth Maul. The thing is Obi-Wan knows exactly how to counter that attack because he's thought through it. Mm-hmm. When Anakin jumps, he's like, ah, bye-bye appendages. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's also interesting because it's like the character of Vader has met his match in someone who's very, very different. But like the mirroring is so good in that film. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It also just looks dope.
I agree. It is an awesome scene. And I do love how they ended, especially with the whole, you know, you were the chosen one. And that does reflect that whole idea, that theme that I was talking about earlier about love, where, you know, he says, you were my brother, Anakin. I loved you. And then you see how that Anakin was fighting for earlier has turned completely, and he's completely changed from what he was before. This man who was fighting for this love for Padme, and now that he's lost everything, he just lashes out in anger. So very good. Once again, for those female audiences who aren't Star Wars fans, they might have liked it more if there was half the fighting, but you know.
Well, if you don't like fighting, then don't watch this movie.
Well, maybe it's not as good of a movie then. It could have told the same story with less fight scenes.
No, because good fight scenes that are put into a movie well, instead of making the whole movie a fight scene, are objectively good.
It's an objective good. I see. So there, all of that standing on those pipes fighting each other was really necessary for telling a compelling story. It's not a John Wick move at all.
Why are you laughing? You know what? You started this. So now I'm going to end it.
Okay.
For all of you John Wick lovers out there, John Wick, as a movie, as a franchise, is a mess. It's a disgrace to all of cinema. It is murder porn. It should not exist. If you enjoy that sort of movie, then say I enjoy watching people get cut up and killed, and I would love to live in the time of the Romans so I could go watch it in real life. Don't say you like a real movie, because you don't. A real movie has a plot. It has plot twists, it has actual character development, it has wonderful dialogue, and it has good music to go along with it. John Wick has none of these, and even if it might approach some of those, it doesn't execute them well. And it most definitely comes nowhere close to the fight scene in Star Wars Episode 3, in which we actually lead up to something with decent dialogue, a beautiful score, a wonderful setting, and we actually end with something happening instead of a be seeing you, John.
There you go. So did this movie leave you satisfied?
In more ways than one.
So you enjoyed it. That's great. Yeah, I enjoyed it too. Would you change your rating after this discussion?
No. Yeah. Would you?
I'd probably give it a few points lower, but you know, overall it's pretty good. No, I'm just kidding. I'll leave it where it is. It's a good spot. I think it's an excellent movie. I really enjoy watching it. I'll watch it any day. There's some iconic scenes that I watch. I will say this movie does have some strong nostalgia for me, though. I will say that. It was the first Star Wars I saw in theaters. I was little when I watched it, and it was iconic, you know. So has great memories for me. I'm not going to say that doesn't play into my personal enjoyment of the movie, but I don't think that affects the rating so much. Like I said, I think Gladiator is got a higher score for a reason. I think that there's other movies that I like, such as Transformers, because of the nostalgia, but the storyline is actually crap, and I'm willing to say that. So I think that those two things can be separated, nostalgia and actual quality of a movie. And this one still has a good rating. Huh?
I said, now John Wick has neither of those.
It does not have nostalgia for me. That is for sure.
I don't know. Sure. If you have nostalgia for that, then you got some problems with your childhood.
After trying to watch it 4 times and only succeeding once, you can say I'm not a fan of John Wick. That is the pod. We hope you all enjoy. We will be back, as always, next week. See you then.